So I've introduced you as an environmental justice lawyer working with water keepers.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you can maybe just give us a bit of introduction as how you began your work in environmental law and where your work has taken you today now focusing on water.
Yeah, I started, my legal practice on Bay Street at Osler's and left that to practice criminal defense work. My family has some history in Kitchener-Waterloo. My brother Harold Matson is still a criminal lawyer there, and another lawyer from the 60s and 70s there, Doug Chapman, was a criminal lawyer, and he had moved on into environmental work. So when I started a practice with him, we did some criminal work, prison work, and did a little bit of environmental law, and we were prosecuting for the Ministry of Environment on contract, and that's really what introduced me to the area and got me excited and interested in it. As a result of that, I became more and more involved. I started representing community group, ratepayer groups, and environmental issues. And then with the cutbacks in the mid-90s, felt there was a need to maybe sort of replace, or not replace, but fill the vacuum left by the cutbacks of the Harris government. And I actually started doing a lot of pro bono work in terms of trying to enforce environmental law in Ontario and Canada. That work continued, and I started a small group called the Environmental Bureau of Investigation, and eventually that morphed into my own organization with Kristen Tully, who's still here as the vice president, and that's the Lake Ontario Waterkeeper. Waterkeepers had a history in North America, starting with the Hudson River Keeper in the 60s, and really it was about communities who no longer wanted to just protest or, you know, have to break the law in order to get it enforced. They instead decided that they were going to start enforcing the law, and they were commercial fishermen and people like that who felt that their rights were being taken away, their rights to fish, swim, and drink the water. And so they just started enforcing the laws. And Robert Kennedy Jr. in 96 pulled together this small, you know, 5 to 10, a handful of waterkeeper groups, riverkeeper, baykeeper groups, and formed the Waterkeeper Alliance, which continues today, and I'm on the board of that organization, whose headquarters is in New York, and Robert Kennedy Jr. is still the president, and I'm the board representative for the Canadian Waterkeeper Groups, and we have 10 of them. So that's a long way of bringing you up to speed.
Yeah, very informative.
On my involvement and how I sort of got to where I am today.
Yeah, thank you. Can you give us the lowdown on the Great Lakes today? Because that's something that affects all of us in Southern Ontario. Like, what state are they in right now, and as an ecosystem and as habitats?
Yeah, the short answer to that is the Great Lakes really are on the verge of collapse. And in the next 2 or 3 years, unless something dramatic takes place, we're going to see the results of a real collapse of our fisheries, of our ability to use the Great Lakes for recreation. And even threatening of our ability to use the Great Lakes for drinking water and for all else that, you know, the 40 million people in the Great Lakes use the Great Lakes for. There's a lot of positive messages coming out of sanctioned official, you know, government official reports how we've improved the Great Lakes over the last few years by banning PCBs, for example, by putting sewage treatment plants on many of our cities. They like to use the imagery in the late 60s, early 70s of Lake Erie as being a dead lake, and how its miraculous recovery is an indicator of how well government's done in bringing back the lakes. But really, this is just this is really just an illusion. The reality is that the Great Lakes are more contaminated today than they have ever been. Maybe the PCBs have gone down, but there are other chemicals that we haven't even begun to realize the damage they're doing that are at their all-time highs. Consumption limits on fish are at their all-time highs. The loss of fish habitat and migratory bird habitat in the Great Lakes are at their all-time high. Lake Ontario, for example, 70% of its wetlands are lost. Our harbors, toxic sediments in our harbors are at their all-time high, and little, if anything, is being done about getting them out of our natural environment and ecosystem. The Great Lakes are being used more and more by industry for, you know, cooling their big plants and discharging whatever remnants of their industrial processes back into the Great Lakes. They're being used for, shipping, and the lax laws on shipping allow them to, discharge empty cargo into the bottom of the lakes, or, some of the exotic species that are coming in the ships from other parts of the world, which are destroying our own natural ecosystem. So we've got huge problems. I think those are the actual indicators in the environment, but maybe the biggest problem we see at Lake Ontario Waterkeeper is also that they're not enforcing the laws that were meant to protect the fish, the wildlife, humans, drinking water, the ability to use the water, swim in it, and to eat the fish. And we've got great laws, and they're not being enforced. They're being sidelined and, being ignored. And we're doing that at our peril. And then on the American side of the lakes, the same is taking place. And we hear a lot about the Bush rollbacks of the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. And it's true. It's tremendous rollbacks of laws that are meant to protect our Great Lakes, and we're seeing them disappear as well. So we're at a crisis time on the Great Lakes, and we certainly see it as we travel around, and I do travel around. We've got 14 waterkeepers on the Great Lakes, and I hear about what's happening in the local communities, and it's not good. The only time I hear good news about the Great Lakes is when it comes out of Ottawa or Washington, or even, Toronto or Albany, where they talk about sort of their past successes. And we hear about their past successes so often that we think that, that's indicative of the overall health of the Great Lakes, and it's just not true.
That's pretty sad. Well, it's terribly sad.
Sorry, Matt, I can't hear you.
Sorry. Just saying that it's terribly sad.
Yeah, it's sad, and it can make you angry, too, but...
Yeah.
There are a lot of great people in the Great Lakes who are working tremendously hard to change things around. So, hopefully 2006 is the year we can turn some sort of corner and start taking this seriously.
Mm-hmm. I read an article on your website that there is an old fire retardant polluting Great Lakes sediment and fish, and I guess that must be like one of the many newest discoveries now.
Yeah, PBDEs, polybromated diethyl. Which is, whenever you have the word poly, just like PCBs or poly, it's a chemical that lasts a long time in the environment. That's why it's used as a fire retardant. So if you put it on your couch, it'll last for 10, 15, 20 years. And PCBs were the same thing. They were meant to last a long time and not break down quickly. So they're very much like PCBs in our environment. We don't have standards. We have no real regulations on them. They're being sprayed on almost everything, and they're being dumped oftentimes right into the Great Lakes. The Leslie Spit here in Toronto is called a dumping zone for what we call clean fill. And because the PBDEs aren't something that we measure or restrict or regulate, they can go into the water as clean. And the Leslie Spit, in fact, is the second highest concentrations of PBDEs found in the lake. And there's been a lot of recent research being done on it. They're showing up in milk, breast milk in women. They're showing up in our food. They're showing up in the Arctic. They're showing up in the, in Toronto Harbor. They're showing up everywhere. And this is a very serious problem, again, that we better, pull our heads out of the sand and figure out what's going on here and deal with it before, again, we're going to deal with, what PCBs did to our environment in the 70s. This could clearly take place in the next 4 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, I guess in July there was a release of 2 draft agreements that set out who gets to take water from the Great Lakes, how much they can take, and that was signed in December. Can you please share with us what's going on with extraction of water from the Great Lakes? Like, who's taking water and what for and how much?
Yeah, sure. There's been just some background on the annex agreement, and the annex is an agreement. It's annexed to the Great Lakes Charter Agreement, which is an agreement between the United States and Canada regarding the Great Lakes. And there's, I think there's 11 or 12 different annex to that agreement. And there's been a lot of concern about taking 20% of the world's fresh waters in the Great Lakes, and that may seem like a lot, but it's actually not that much water overall, and there's been a great concern that the southern United States may need fresh water and are going to want to take it. So historically, the provinces and the states all agreed that you wouldn't be able to take Great Lakes water unless there was unanimity among the eight states and the provinces in Canada. There were some threats, some lawsuits coming out of Colorado threatening these laws and these agreements made between the states in particular as being unconstitutional. So as sort of a preemptive strike, we've had these negotiations in the last couple of years trying to find new ways to protect the Great Lakes water. And the annex agreement and the finalized version that's going forward is an attempt to do that. There are different opinions as to whether or not it's strong enough or whether it's really addressed the problem. My group's position is that it's not strong enough. It should be stronger. I don't blame the Ontario government for not making it stronger because we had very little leverage over the eight American states, but I have worked with the waterkeepers in the states, and we've been trying to get it stronger. But right now, although there's a lot of a lot of celebration about this agreement as an effort to try and protect the Great Lakes, which it is, I don't think it plugs the holes. I think we have a whole lot more work to do, and we're going to need to be on guard and watchful over the next 5 to 10 years to really ensure that urban sprawl outside the Great Lakes watershed in places like Wisconsin and Indiana and Illinois, where the towns are expanding out of the watershed and, in fact, you know, even watering their grass, that water will never get back to the Great Lakes. It'll head down the Mississippi and into the Gulf. We've got to be very careful that these communities and this sprawl doesn't lead to endless sinkhole for Great Lakes water, because the Great Lakes are, you know, basically they're 1% renewable. That means that every year only 1% of the Great Lakes water is renewed. So a lot of people like to consider it a one-time gift, and it's, you know, just a bunch of big pools of a glacial deposit of fresh water, and we can't think that if we just let the water go that it'll somehow naturally come back. It won't, and we have to be very careful, and we have to be guardians of this water for all, you know, for all our communities. And that if you want fresh water, I think the theory should be that you should move to the Great Lakes as opposed to move the Great Lakes to Phoenix or to the south. And that's what I've been talking about. You know, the greatest resource for our cities on the Great Lakes are the Great Lakes waters. So we have to keep that in mind and not sell our water to someone else, because we won't be getting it back. It'd be like selling the farm or, you know, draining the pond to get at the fish, and it's not a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Are there agreements already in place with...
Sorry, what's that?
Are there agreements already in place with states taking water?
Well, each state and province, we have our own laws,
mm-hmm.
And then there are federal laws in the United States, and there are federal laws in Canada, and then there are these international agreements that the annexes, the Great Lakes Charter agreements. Each, you know, certain laws trump other laws. Some are constitutional, some are non-constitutional. And if all the laws that we had in place were enforced and respected, there wouldn't be an issue. The concern is whether we have enough protections, and that's what the groups have been grappling with, and they're trying to address through this new annex agreements. It's still, you know, as I say, there's still varied opinion on whether or not we've accomplished that. We still feel here at Waterkeeper that we need an outright ban on water diversions from the Great Lakes, and anything less than that is not protective and is in some ways reckless. And we do not have an outright ban on Great Lakes water yet, even with these new agreements. So that's where we're at.
I've been hearing rumors for a while. I don't know how much you know about Guelph, but I've been hearing rumors that it's a fact that we've been depleting the aquifer so much, and just urban sprawl, you know, characteristically is ruining the replenishment of the aquifer. But I've been hearing rumors that we're going to build a pipe from Lake Erie, I think, to pump water up here. Do you know anything about that at all?
Yeah, I mean, Kitchener-Waterloo in particular, I'm not sure, so sure about Guelph. But Kitchener-Waterloo, you know, because they're on groundwater, and their groundwater is contaminated, TCE particularly is a concern in Kitchener-Waterloo. There are levels, even this year I know they closed one of the eight wells down because of the levels of TCE, and I know Canada, 50 parts per billion is the safe level, whereas in the States, it's 5 parts per billion. And so, you know, 10 times more protective. So Kitchener-Waterloo's water is risky, and what they have a plan to do is to build a pipeline to Lake Huron. Now people are saying, well, you can't build Lake Huron because that would drain Lake Huron, and you need to build it on your own watershed, which means that Lake Kitchener-Waterloo would have to build the pipeline to Lake Erie because that's where the Grand and where the watershed flows to. So their plan, I think, is to have it by 2030. They need Great Lakes water. They need it bad, and it's not just because they're running out of groundwater. It's because they're running out of clean groundwater. And it's a real threat to that community. I mean, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars of investments, and, you know, this is the heart and soul of every community, its ability to access fresh water. Guelph, I'm not as sure about your particular situation in Guelph, and it may be an issue of demand.
Mm-hmm.
But again, yeah, if one of the things we take for granted, but all these huge, beautiful cities on the Great Lakes, you know, they're the first reason for them being here and the number one reason for them staying and being healthy into the future is because they have access to, you know, an incredible resource of fresh, clean drinking water. And those cities, which there are very few of in Ontario, but the city, you know, there are a lot of rural towns and villages that are on groundwater, but the cities, there are very few. And the exceptions, like Kitchener-Waterloo, that are getting their drinking water from groundwater are, you know, are facing a particular and unique problem with quantity and with quality. And that's, I think, when we hear rumors, they're not really rumors, they are real concerns that maybe haven't been, you know, or discussed enough in the community or in our local press, but really they are they're the key to our futures, and we need to really understand these issues more. And if Kitchener-Waterloo is going to link up to the Great Lakes, I can tell you the new annex agreements would say that Kitchener-Waterloo would have to get its water from Grand River or from Lake Erie because that's its watershed. If it took it from Lake Huron, it would be taking that water out of Lake Huron for good and discharging it to Lake Erie. And although it goes back in the Great Lakes, it would be having a drain on the Lake, Michigan and Lake Huron, Georgian Bay, and that watershed. So it's a concern.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if I could ask you a bit broader of a question, just for those listeners like myself who haven't taken biological sciences or ecology.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give a somewhat holistic picture of how the Great Lakes region works as an ecosystem, like how aquifers and groundwater works with tributaries, creeks, and swamps, the importance of all those to funneling into the Great Lakes, and the effects of certain developments going on right now? It's a basic question, but it's also quite holistic as well.
I can try. I mean, being a lawyer, I mean, most of what I learned about science and biology and hydrogeology and hydrology has come through hearings I've been involved in with either putting my experts forward or cross-examine others' experts.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you're saying basically is that, the Great Lakes, that there's one huge watershed, which is the Great Lake watershed,
mm-hmm.
and then there are smaller watersheds that revolve around Lake Superior, Lake Huron, Lake Michigan, Georgian Bay, Lake Huron, or Lake Ontario, Lake Erie, and even Lake St. Clair, and then out to St. Lawrence. And each one, there's groundwater discharges. That groundwater will take Toronto, the Oak Ridges Moraine. The groundwater comes up, feeds into the rivers, and then the rivers feed into the lake. So we've got groundwater discharges, and then we have surface water discharges, and they run from the groundwater, and they'll run in different directions to different lakes. So those are the watersheds of the Great Lakes, and that's how we, that's how we replenish the lakes up to 1% annually.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the new water. And then the water that's already in these lakes are sort of, they really are deposits. I've seen different studies, that talk about how many years it takes water from Lake Superior to sort of go past Kingston. And some studies say if you just looked at that one molecule, on average, it would take like 200, 250 years. So it's a long time. And I think one thing, and when you're looking at the environment in a holistic way, people should realize that, the lakes don't empty and fill back up on a yearly basis. That same water, 99% of it's the same water each and every year. So, in our lifetime as a human being, it's basically the same lake.
Yeah.
So when you're discharging pollutants into it, that's basically there for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people don't. A lot of people, in particular, developers and politicians, for the most part, don't really understand the importance of such things as bogs and swamps and creeks and feel it's fairly irrelevant that one may be paved over, but it's one at a time, at a time, at a time,
mm-hmm.
that builds up, eh?
That's 100% right, Matt. And I, Waterkeeper, one thing we do like to focus on is the uses that people make of the water, including, you know, the uses, there are ecological uses and wildlife uses, which we talk about all the time, but there are also uses, you know, the ability to go fishing or to the ability to go swimming, the ability to drink the water, really important. And politicians and developers, what they constantly do is they say, well, you can get it someday. There's an alternative. You can get your fish at the market. You can go swimming at the pool, or we'll provide, you know, a park somewhere else. So we'll provide, you know, 200 meters of water here where you can swim. And with drinking water, well, we'll provide, you can buy it from different places. We can ship it in. You don't need to get it from here. And slowly but surely, they devalue the uses that are being made of the local community. Say they can replace it, and for whatever reason, you know, they've been able to get away with this for years and years and years. We're slowly running out of places to replace what we're taking over. Land use and expansion is, you know, rendering the Great Lakes almost irrelevant. It's killing off. You know, the ability to, you know, as a real ecosystem, it's like I say, we're on the verge of collapse. It's turning the Great Lakes, you know, threatening our drinking water. The beaches on the Great Lakes, it's just the saddest thing you've ever seen. I don't think there's a city across Canada, other than Calgary, really, where I've been, where the cities have urban beaches. They're so rare to find urban beaches. In other words, beaches where we have most of the people live, and where most of the people really should have access to the Great Lakes. Most of our cities are on the Great Lakes, but the beaches are all contaminated and polluted. It's just, you know, that really is a crime. And for a city like Toronto, for example, with 50 kilometers of a waterfront, and they provide us now with only 10 beaches, 200 meters each, and those beaches are closed more than 50% of the time. In other words, they're picking some of the best spots where they think they can put people to swim, and even though those places are closed more than 50% of the time, it's a tragedy, and that, you know, that again is killing the political constituency. We need to force politicians and developers, you know, to take care of these things, because if we don't have people down there enjoying it, loving it, and getting to know it, then it's easier for the politicians and the officials and the developers to sort of say, you know, this is a valueless area, and what we're going to do is going to bring value to the area, and what we're destroying really is meaningless and not important. So we're really constantly trying to get people to get out there and use their waterways again, learn to love them, treasure them, and you know, treat them like they should be treated, which is you know, an incredible resource and really a gift to our communities, and ultimately the reason why our communities are where they are, and I think the future of our communities. And if we did that, I think we'd have a much better argument when faced with, you know, with these proposals to destroy natural ecosystems, wetlands, etc.
Mm-hmm. It's quite a catch-22, because few people want to go enjoy the rivers near their homes because they are so polluted, but we have to make just prove that they do have value.
I know. I compare it to sort of these are acts of civil disobedience when you go swimming now in your urban beaches, because you're basically saying to the risk assessors for the government and stuff that don't say that we don't swim here. We do, and I'm going to go swim here, and that's going to make your life miserable, because you're going to have to take that into account when you say, hey, there's no problem here. We're really risking our own, you know, health in many ways. But if we don't go swimming in these areas, then they can say, well, nobody swims here, so there's no problem. Don't mm-hmm. worry about the E. coli, because no one swims there. Nobody, you know, there is no one who eats the fish in this area, so there's no problem. Nobody drinks the water, or, you know, lets their dogs or whatever drink out of these areas, therefore there's no problem. And that's the way risk assessments work. And so when they say everything's fine, I don't know what, you know, what Waterkeeper or Matson's talking about. Most of the time, it's because they put up a fence, they keep people out, they put up signs, say, don't swim, don't fish, don't drink in these areas, and then everything is fine. It looks nice, but if you're actually out there using these waters, you know, it creates more problems for the officials, it creates more problems for those who want to destroy it, and it certainly acts as a protector of the ecosystem. And, you know, our birds, our fish, our wildlife, they don't read these signs. They can't just look up and say, oh, no, don't swim here, you know. And so they're in these areas all the time. And so, you know, the fact that we're telling humans not to do these things and we're supposed to read the signs and, you know, follow a reasonable course, it's not helping the wildlife. And I see that a lot with respect to nuclear power in particular. They can do reactors, release a lot of tritium, and they could minimize the amount of tritium going out into our lakes. But what they do is they come up with a number. Okay, Lake Ontario, for people drinking the water at Lake Ontario, we will release this much because at that level it's still safe. And then they look at Lake Huron, well, we can release more because there's more water and it gets diluted more. And then they go to the Bay of Fundy, where Point Lepreau reactor is, and they go, well, nobody drinks the water at a Bay of Fundy, so just release it all. And you're going, well, what about the whales, and what about the birds, and what about the, you know, the sea lions? And they mm-hmm. just don't come up on the risk assessment methodology, and it's tragedy, really. And that's the way it is. You know, I'm using one example, but that's really the way it is in our local rivers and streams in our towns, where, if, mm-hmm. you know, as long as they say don't swim in these areas, there doesn't seem to be a problem with discharging sewage overflow or stormwater into the area. They don't really care about those little, that ecosystem, you know, along the Speed River.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just reminds me that anthropocentrism is just one of the
hugest...
Just reminds me that anthropocentrism is one of the hugest problems.
That's true, yeah.
And these people fail to recognize the extreme importance of a diverse ecosystem like biodiversity, and you know, we need that, and people seem to think we can live fine as humans without animals or birds around us. It's kind of insane.
I agree. It's so selfish and myopic of us, and it's... What's funny, it's not funny, but it's tragic, not funny, it's not comedic, is that our laws do recognize the importance of the ecosystem, and the Migratory Bird and Treaties Act and the Fisheries Act, the two most important pieces of environmental legislation in this country, are directed at protecting the ecosystem, and they're being proactive, and yet, you know, the Migratory Bird Act is hardly ever enforced in this country. And the Fisheries Act, you know, waterkeepers have been doing enforcement of it, and we've been talking about it, and I've gone across the country and educating communities about the importance of this law. But generally, it's, you know, governments have you know, put the Fisheries Act sort of in the pile with, you know, other lost laws. They're just not using it. Industry's terrified of it. It's really strong. I think it's up to $5 million a day for offenses, and you can go to jail for up to 6 months. It's an incredible piece of legislation to, you know, preventing the deposit of the deleterious substance into waters frequented by fish. The same thing with respect to the migratory bird, preventing the deposit of a deleterious substance into waters frequented by migratory birds. These are strong, powerful pieces of legislation that protect the ecosystem. And by doing so, they also protect communities and humans. But there's such a lack of will on the part of government to enforce them because of the lobbying of industry and you know, local politics that gets involved, where they don't want their industry to have to follow these, you know, meaningful environmental standards because they're worried the industry might close down or move to a place that won't enforce them. It's just tragic. And you know, most of the work we do now is, you know, is trying to get those laws enforced, because we do see it as an incredible way to take it out of the political realm, put it in the courts, and, you know, get where it's transparent, where it's public, where the courts have the ability to force these decisions at the threat of fine and jail. And we'd like to see that system, to try that system out, to see if, you know, if Canada truly can live up to its commitments to protect the environment, like these laws that we wrote 40, 50 years ago with good intentions were supposed to do. So... Mm-hmm. It is interesting that they do try and protect the ecosystem and not humans, and yet at the end of the day, we become so myopic and look at it purely from our own self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate.